Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
Well, good evening on this, 4th of July weekend, 2025. So just great to have you here. We're live in the most awesome and beautiful city, I believe, in the world, Houston, Texas. And I was watching and listening. I could literally go out to my balcony right here on the 19th floor of my building and listen to what's happening at the NRG Stadium right across the street. It was where the USA and the Mexico are playing for the Gold Cup tonight in soccer. That means some things to some people. Soccer is not a big thing of mine, but I was watching it. It looks like Mexico is going to win. They're up 2-1 right now, and it's just about over. But, hey, go USA. Go Mexico. We love them all, but it's just kind of exciting. I know traffic was terrible today right here. Around medical center here at Houston. Welcome to the program tonight. We're live and we are having the guest that has built up anticipation because we thought she was going to be here last week, but I just sat and talked for an hour, but she is here live tonight, all the way from the awesome country of Canada, and we're going to bring her in just in a second. But you can get involved in the program tonight. You will want to make sure you have a pencil and a paper to figure out how to write down the books that you want to buy and how you can get a hold of them. Also, we're going to share some things that parents may need to be able to understand how to deal with their kids, how to deal with their grandchildren. Children are so precious. I tell you, we've been dealing with the last couple of days, those terrible floods that have been happening up in North Texas, where over 50 people have been killed. A couple dozen children, little girls, are missing from a camp, and they're being found dead, floating down the river. It's just unbelievable what's happening with the flooding just north of here in Texas. I dealt with a young girl today that lost two of her friends. Well, one of her friends, for sure, they found her body, but the other one's still missing from these unbelievable, horrendous floods. Kids are precious. They are absolute treasure in our world. And our guest tonight's going to have a little expertise in that, and I'm anxious to get her on. And there's several ways to get involved tonight. You can get on our Facebook, Shattered by the Darkness Facebook page and watch it there and actually comment there. Or you can text me at 832-396-6525. And during the commercial break at the bottom of the hour, in about 25 minutes, I'll check it. And I'm already getting text here already. And read that question or comment, or better yet, you can call 888-627-6008, and it's a free call all the way around the world, and talk live to our guest tonight. Have a comment, TJ, or officially known as Thomas, will pass you right on to our caller and to our guest tonight and me, and we will be able to talk and chat, and you can share your thoughts and wisdom or question that you have. You know, it's been one of those weeks this week that even though we got a day off Friday because of the 4th of July, that it was a stressful week. It seemed like the week never ended. And, you know, there's some things that happens in my life that I just want to share with you real quick, then we'll bring our guest in, that I'm preaching to the choir tonight. I'm literally might as well just go to the bathroom mirror and talk to myself because it's exactly what I need to hear in my own life. There's some things that I need to learn how to let go of, to release in my life, to finally gain. I'm going to be 62 years old, in a few weeks. Gain peace. But I'm not talking about peace of around me, peace within me. And you may want to jot these down. I'm going to go through several. If I don't get them all tonight, I'll finish it up next week. But there's things that I need to release to achieve peace. And one of those is my worst enemy, my own self-judgment. I need to release self-judgment. And I don't know if our guest tonight, Dana, does this or not, but sometimes when we get a new book, we're our worst critic. We see all the little flaws. Oh, if I could only had to do it again, I would have done it this way. And that ends up taking all that inner peace away. And why does it matter? Is because criticism keeps you tight. It keeps you tense. It keeps you bottled up. It keeps you just shaken up all the time. And we shouldn't be doing that. And one thing I want you to do this week, if you're your worst enemy and you have never released self-judgment, when a harsh thought comes to your mind, pause. Don't act. Don't comment. Don't react. And just say, hey, I'm learning, and keep on moving. Don't let it eat your lunch. Another thing that I want you to try to release this week as we go into the first, well, I guess it's the second week, but the first full week of July, the need to rush. We are in a society that is so filled with technology. We're in a society that when I actually get in my car, I want to hurry up and get wherever I'm going. I don't want a stoplight to be red, and I leave here and only work a couple blocks down the street, right there in that building. And at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, there's nobody on the streets, but I feel like I'm in traffic, that I'm always in a rush hour, and it's my own, again, worst enemy. And why does it matter? Is because rushing fuels, it fills my tank of stress, and it disconnects me from pausing to look at things that I'm passing on the street, the things that I need to enjoy. A lot of times we'll walk right past a beautiful rose garden to hurry up and get into a building. Every now and then we just need to slow down. And I truly believe that, you know what, a to-do thing to do under this one is to just stop and take a few breaths. And I tell you, maybe Dan and I will talk about this on here shortly, but I think kids are caught up in a technology-filled world. Every now and then, they need to put all that junk down and just breathe and just pause and take in life. My greatest memory sometimes as a kid, and there wasn't that many, was to walk down to the little lake that was down the street in the country of Southern Illinois and crush a Coke can, a soda can, and kick that can all the way down the road and just walk down the road kicking the can. And that was so much fun. We don't do that anymore. We're always in a hurry to get someplace. Number three. I need to release, and then I'm going to stop here and I'll pick up the rest of them next week. I need to release comparison. I'm always comparing myself to other people. I'll get on LinkedIn, and I don't know if our guest tonight has LinkedIn in Canada or not, but LinkedIn is one of those things where it's supposedly a very professional Facebook type of page, but it's professional. It's a networking site. And I get on there, and somebody is promoting themselves. Somebody is posting all these pictures of themselves about being in all these places. I don't do any of that because I don't like any of this stuff. But then I'm thinking, well, maybe I ought to try to start competing. No, I don't. But why does that matter? Is because comparing myself to other people automatically dims the joy that I have been given in my own role, in my own lane in life. This is what I do. This is how I do it. And this is the way I do it. And if I start comparing myself to other people, that's why I normally don't like to listen to anybody else speak. I try not to read. I read a lot, but I try not to read books about things that I speak on because I want to speak for my own instead of trying to copy somebody else. I've been given, and you have been given, and you have been wired a purpose, a God-given destiny. And our children are bent in certain ways and raised in certain ways that they should be able to be nurtured to fulfill the way that they were created instead of trying to always compete with somebody else. And what do you do when it shows up in our life? We just need to say, hey, that's great. Congratulations. But that path isn't the path for me. That's three things that I just want to share with you tonight that I want you to release. And we'll do the rest of them some other time. I just kind of jotted them down here on a piece of paper. And we'll share the next four or five or six or seven the next coming weeks. But thank you for being with us on the program tonight. I want to let you know, TJ, go ahead and bring in this beautiful lady from Canada, if you would, so people can see her face. And hopefully maybe see her dogs run through the house here in a minute. But it is great to have Dana Sutton with us. She is a tutor, a coach, and I think probably more importantly, a parent with decades of experience working with children and biological children, adopted children, stepchildren, and young adults. And she's also worked in preschool, been a substitute teacher, and nobody knows probably better than her that the hardest job on the face of this earth is to be a substitute teacher. She is now going down a lane of life of trying to write books and doing a beautiful job of it to inspire, empower, give wisdom in a series of children's books. And the two books that she has out right now is You Can Do Hard Things, and her most latest is Maddie Finds Her Place. She loves athletics. We'll talk about that a little bit, but she resides in Canada, and I'll let her tell you what location in Canada. I've never been there, but I want to go there. But Dana, welcome to the program tonight, and it is an honor to have you with us. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Gregory, for having me, especially after our incident last week. I really appreciate being here with you.
Well, we didn't have anybody call and get mad. Of course, I'd let people know who's on, but I don't let people really, I don't broadcast it until I actually say, hey, bring her in to make sure they're there. But it's good to have you with us. When you started deciding, hey, I think I may have a book or two in me. Are these the first two books that you have written in your entire life?
These are the first two books that I've written. I had it came about. I had a few different people suggesting that I write some parenting books, and I often laughed and said, yeah, maybe when I retire, because I do own a business and work full time and do all of those things. And then at one point, I was actually walking to work, and I thought, you could take some of those lessons. A parenting book is a large endeavor with lots of work over years. And I thought, but if you did it one lesson at a time, you could make those into children's books that are enjoyable for children and also helping to teach parents. And I thought that maybe that's a route that I would give it a go. And so we did the first book called You Can Do Hard Things, and it went really well. I really liked the results of it, and decided to keep going with it. So Maddie Finds Her Place has come out this year, and I have two more books that are in the illustration phase right now. We're with Nicholas, so he's working on the pictures for the next two books. And yeah, it's been a really interesting experience. I've enjoyed it.
Is it the same illustrator for all the books so far?
It is so
Because
far,
it's great.
yes.
Whoever's doing it is Nicholas.
Yeah, his name is Nicholas, and yeah, he's been I've been really happy with his drawings. It was funny. I realized my inexperience showed in the first book, You Can Do Hard Things, in that it came to a point where I was supposed to describe the pictures as I envisioned them. And to be very blunt, I have no vision. I close my eyes and you say, what does a flower look like? I can't tell you. I can mimic what I see. I can, you know, that kind of thing, but the visual acuity is not mine. And so the second book, Maddie Finds Her Place, I did a little more work on trying to put more information in. And yeah, Nicholas did a bang up job. So we've been really happy. And as I said, he's just done pencil sketches for book three, and he's working on the pe pencil sketches now for book four as well.
Well, that's fantastic. Are you able to relate to that critique inside of you of comparing yourself or being your own worst enemy when you look at your book when it first comes out? Did you do those things that I did with every one of my books?
Yes, yeah, I definitely not so, for me, it's not so much comparing myself with other people, but very self-critical, very,
Yeah.
oh, okay, I should have done this better. Oh, I can see that I didn't do that as well. Oh, okay. You know, and I'm, you know, I think it starts off with good intentions when you have those thoughts, right? You want to get better and you want to improve, and but it can definitely go down a road where it's too much, and maybe you should just sit back and appreciate what you've done and move forward, you know.
So is your game plan and has your game plan always been to write a book that's different for children than, hey, I like green eggs and ham? Because there's really, you read that and you go, okay, what did I learn out of life's lesson? Although you do learn life lessons in some of Dr. Seuss's books, but it was just more of a giggle, giggle, and close it. Yours aren't that way. From what I understand, and when I've read them, it's like, wait. This is a thought process. This is a building up of what goes on in real life. And this is something that the parent and the child can have a conversation about while they're reading the book and still have the feel of an entertaining children's book. Is that what you had planted from day one?
Yeah, that was definitely the intention with the first book especially. It was you know, I was saying to myself, like, what is the most important thing that I learned from my parents, that they learned from their parents, that I want hope that I taught my children? And I realized it's just that I was capable, and
Oh.
that being capable was it wasn't keep your elbows off the table when you're eating. It wasn't do your homework or study hard, or those weren't the really important lessons. The most important lesson was that they believed that I was capable. And so then I believed I was capable. And so when I wrote the first book, that really was the whole idea behind it, was helping parents understand it. Because in my years of tutoring, I often noticed that the parents didn't believe in the kids. Right. They were sort of picking at them, or sort of, I want him to do better, and I want him to. And the number of times I had a conversation where I said, okay, stop. Your child is working hard and studying hard. And so the results they are achieving reflect their ability in this particular case. But this one spot in their life isn't going to be their life. School isn't life. And so you need to open up your horizons a little bit and look at your child and realize they have all these other things that are going to be what they use to succeed in life. And for some kids, that's their social ability. Some kids, it's their empathy. Some kids, it's their athleticism. Like, there's so many different areas that aren't reflected in schoolwork in and of itself. But the importance is that you have to
Did
believe
you
in them.
learn these life lessons not only with your own children and maybe the teaching wisdom that you have, but how did coaching influence like this first book? I can you got the ability to be able to accomplish something. Did you incorporate that in your coaching and learn that from coaching that sometimes all you need to do is put your arm around one of those children and say, "Hey, you got this." It's in you. It's okay. Life doesn't break
Yeah.
or make on this one kick.
Yeah.
How did coaching fuel that tank of wisdom for you too?
Well, there's a few different ways. I mean, the very first way is one of my sports was fastball. And when I was five, I started playing t-ball, and my dad and one of the other gentlemen was the coach, and they took the age group, 5 and 6 year olds. And my dad and his friend took all of the 6 year olds, and the other guys took all of, or my dad and his friend took all the 5 year olds, and the other coaches took all the 6 year olds. And that's just how they split the team up. It was a community team, and on we went. And at 14 years old, every single one of the 5 year olds on Dad and Gary's team played AAA fastball. Every single one of them. And that's not a reflection of a year of childbirth where every child was exceptional. It was coaching that addressed every child has potential and you meet them where they're at. And that was probably one of the first ones. And then at 13 years old, when we were going to a tournament and hadn't lost a game in 32 games and were getting quite cocky and obnoxious, the same two coaches got to the tournament and said, "Hey, we're not coaching this week. We're just going to be fans. You guys coach yourselves, have a good time. We're going to sit over here on the sidelines with the rest of the parents and watch, and good luck. Have fun." And we lost every single game that weekend until Sunday morning, which was a humbling experience for sure. And really, again, reinforced just how much influence having that coaching person there, that adult that was observing and providing support and just the little feedback. I mean, they weren't in our face coaches. They weren't demanded, but they were there with that small voice. So I received that in my coaching. And then also my parents never answered a yes or no question with yes or no. So if I said, "Can I go to Nikki's house Friday night for a sleepover?" they didn't say yes or no. They said, "Do you have any sports on Saturday morning?" And I would say, "Oh, yes, not till 10 o'clock." "Okay. Do you have any homework you need to do this weekend?" "Yeah, but we're going to do it Saturday." And so they would walk me through this process again, not controlling my life, not just walking me through the questions I needed to ask myself to answer my own question. And so those two influences really kind of brought me to my parenting style as well, which was that I'm not here to control your life. I'm here to help you keep you between the rails and help you make decisions for yourself. And that was, like you said, that was the idea behind the first book was you can do hard things. And all of the incidents in that first book, right up in the end, actually happened with one or both of my children. So we went through them all. And it's interesting. We've had some really, really positive feedback, and also some feedback where people didn't like it. They didn't think that the topics were appropriate for children. They went too in depth into, like there is a scene in it where it's a young girl talking about her boyfriend, and he doesn't treat me well when people aren't here, Mom. And Mom says, "Well, how does that make you feel? Like, how do you feel about this? Is this making you feel better? Is he contributing? Is he making your life positive?" And we had some negative feedback about that initially, but I brought it forward and I said, "Look, you're reading that as an adult with adult experiences, an adult background, and you're recognizing what could be potentially a red flag in an adult relationship. But a child at 5 or 6 that I'm reading this book for, that conversation is, are our friends good friends in front of everybody else and when everybody else is gone? Are we good friends in both situations?" So that child isn't getting that same visceral reaction to those flags that we might as adults, but it's an opportunity to teach them when they're young that those are red flags.
Yeah, that's great. Do you feel that sometimes, and maybe it sounds like you may have learned this from your parents, as good role models for you? Do you feel sometimes parents rush in to try to solve all the problems for the kids instead of allowing them to, because it's our job as fathers to fix everything. Oh, fix it, fix it. Well, instead of just grabbing that G.I. Joe, and that tells you my age era, and snap the arm back on, wouldn't it be so much better to say, hey, this is how you do it, and do it with them so they can learn the process? Isn't that the same way it is with life's problems? To be able to guide them, like you're mentioning, through
Yeah.
it instead of just getting it over with, learn from
For
this
sure.
day.
For sure. And that was, like I said, that was kind of my whole point in that first book is, hey, my job is to teach you that you can do this. I'll be here. If you fall down, I'll help you get up. We'll dust you off and we'll, put the supports in place. But you can do this. I believe in you. And that was one of the things I used to say, to the parents of kids that I'm tutoring and I'm coaching is that, if you don't believe in them, how can they? Right? If my parents don't believe in me, how can I possibly believe in myself? And that's, you have to, you, it, that's, I think, I believe that is your number one job as a parent.
Yeah, that's good to be there to support, love unconditionally. And I think our world today is filled with conditional parents, that I will only care for you if you do it the way I expect you to. Is there anything that you're seeing in this generation that, if you could write a book to all the parents, to say, hey, you better get a hold of this, guys. This is going to come back to haunt us one day.
I think we're already seeing it, and honestly, that literally was the reason for the first book. You can do hard things is I, I looked around and I saw so many parents solving all the problems, not letting their children fail. I mean, I'll never forget my son at 12 years old. We were going skiing on a Sunday because we had ski hills very close to us and we had season passes and he was quite a skier. And he said, oh, can my friend so-and-so come? And I said, sure, go get him. And off he ran. And he came back 15 minutes later and he was quite depressed. And I said, oh, is he not coming? He said, no, he can't go. He has to study for his chemistry test this week or on Monday. And I said, okay. And off we went to the ski hill. And later that week, I ran into this young fella's mom and, well, didn't Topper have a chemistry exam? And I said, I don't know. He might have. She said, well, like, don't you think you should have been studying? I said, well, if he had a test, he probably should have been studying, yes. But my philosophy was always, and my son, he did fail the odd test, but he failed it when he was in grade 7 or grade 6 when he first started having to manage his own time, and he realized on his own that he did not like to fail, and it had nothing to do with me. It wasn't me standing over top of him telling him he had to study, he couldn't do this, he couldn't do that. He learned he did not like to fail. And he didn't after that. And I didn't have to manage his time. And so, and that was my experience. A lot of my kids growing up, I had a very different philosophy than a lot of the parents around us. But that's what I saw was that, other parents really trying to make them successful. And I wanted mine to fail because I wanted them to learn how. And that the world doesn't end when you fail. We all do it. One of the things my kids will tell you, I always said to them growing up, is if you stop and talk to any person anywhere long enough, you will find out that bad things have happened to them too. The world, right? It's not, the world's not out to get you. And it's not just you that has bad days or has things happen that are difficult or has arguments with friends. Everybody does. And it's not my job to protect you from that. It's my job to lift you up when that happens and dust you off and say, it's okay, we're here. We love you and you can try again tomorrow. And that really
Great,
was the
great, great,
whole
great
point.
wisdom. Great wisdom. Hold up both books. The first one, You Can Do Hard Things. That's the one we've been
Okay.
talking about. And the
Yeah.
newest one is Maddie Finds Her Place. And There They Both Are by Dana Sudden. And I tell you what, while we take this commercial break, won't you get on Amazon? Is that a good place to get it, Dana?
Yeah, you can get it on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, Indigo. It's available on all of those sites.
Let's give them about a minute and a half to order both of those books. We'll take a commercial break. We'll be right back on the other side of this. And Dana, I really want to drill down a little bit deeper. And then I want to find about some of the stories behind the Maddie Finds Her Place on the other side of this break. We'll be right back. 888-627-6008. And while we take this break, listen to the commercial, but go ahead and order the books. We'll be right back.
Get ready for a life-changing journey from the best-selling author of Shattered by the Darkness and When the Dark Clouds Come. Dr. Gregory Williams is back with his highly anticipated third book, Embracing Your Scars, Learning How to Turn Life's Pain into Life's Power and Purpose. Have you ever wondered how to transform your struggles into strength? Do you want to stop hiding behind the pain, the heartache, and instead learn how to turn those scars into the very fuel that propels you towards greatness? If you do, then this book is for you. In Embracing Your Scars, Dr. Williams shows you how to take the negative experiences of your past and turn them into the very source of your future success. Don't miss out, because your transformation begins here. The book is available soon on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, and wherever great books are sold.
All righty, welcome back. I was looking out my window to make sure that they weren't burning Houston down if the soccer team lost, but it looks like everything's calm and cool over there. So I don't know what the score was, but here we go. We have Dana Sudden with us from Canada, the great country of Canada, and she is the author of two awesome books. And I tell you, I've had a lot of children writers and authors on the book on the show, Dana, but I recommend these two over any of them. And I'm probably going to get people to call me or write me and say, "Greg, what did you do that for?" But these are excellent. These are your own lane. These tell stories that I think are important. And this, You Can Do Hard Things, is great. But then this second book, I think it's even personally, I don't know what you think. If you had to put a scale on 1 to 10, which one do you think is more impactful, the first or second book?
I think the second book catches people's attention more, for
I do
sure.
too.
Yeah. It's the second book is actually based on my daughter Maddie. And Maddie, in real life, Maddie came to me out of our Penny Lane homeless shelter, which is the youth homeless shelter here in Kelowna. And she had been in and out of foster care and couch surfed on various people's places. She'd been in and out of homes with various biological family members, and that had started pretty much from birth. She was shifted around quite a bit, and ultimately at 16 she was in a youth homeless shelter. And at the time I'd gone through a divorce. My ex-husband and I had been married for 20 years, and we'd gone through a divorce, and both my biological children were off attending school and doing their thing. And I lived in this big house with myself and 200-pound dogs. And I thought, I'd really like to do some renovations. I think I'll list a couple of the bedrooms for rent. We have a couple of big universities and colleges in our area. And I thought, I'll rent a couple of students. I'll get some income coming in to save for the renovations. Maybe I'll do a little bit of tutoring, because I've tutored everything from preschool right up to first and second year university. So I thought, maybe I'll get some tutoring out of it, and it'll be interesting. And so I put the ads out, and our local Boys and Girls Club called me and asked if I'd be willing to take a child on a youth agreement. And I said, "Well, what's a youth agreement?" And they said, "Well, they're kids who are 16 who've been living in the homeless shelter, who For whatever reason, the Ministry of Children and Family Services has determined they cannot live in their biological family home. They're really too old for foster care. They're sort of in this in between. And so you enter into a landlord agreement with them where the ministry pays the landlord directly for their room and board. And then the child lives there basically as a tenant. And I said, okay, well, that sounds unusual at 16, but let's converse about this a little bit. And I said, well, tell me about this child. And they said, well, they've been here and give me a little background. I said, okay, well, are there any addiction issues? And they said, no, there's no addiction issues. I said, has there been any criminal background or anything like that? And they said, no, none. I said, well, what about sort of educational issues? And no, she's in school and she's on track to graduate and everything else. And I said, okay. So I kind of thought about it for a minute, and I learned years later that the person I was speaking to was on speakerphone, and Maddie was sitting there with her listening. And I didn't know that at the time. And I said, so what you're telling me is that she comes from a seriously messed up family. And she said, yes. And I said, okay, we'll bring her by and we'll meet and we'll see how that goes. So they brought Maddie by, and the day I met her, she'd had her wisdom teeth out that morning, and she was
Oh,
still
wow.
has, suffering the effects a little bit of the anesthetic. And she came in and met our two dogs. I have old English sheepdog. So my male is 110 pounds, and our female that we had at that point was about 95 pounds. And she came in and met the dogs, and we chatted for a bit. And I said, okay, let's bring her in. But they were very clear with me in the beginning that Maddie was going to come in as a tenant, and I'm just a landlord. And so you have landlord rules, but you're not a parent. And I said, okay, that's fine. So she moved in with me in July, and she had the summer. She had a part-time job that summer, worked most of the summer, didn't have a lot of interaction. She'd kind of come in and say hello and go up to her room and close the door, and there wasn't a lot going on. And then in October, my son had come home to do a C. He was doing his electrician certification at the time. So he'd come home for one of his 6 week stints of school while he was doing his apprenticeship. And I was at work during tax season. I own an accounting and payroll firm. So I'd been working late, and it was tax season. And my son called me and said, Mom, you need to come home. And I said, oh, okay, what's going on? He said, I don't know, Mom, but Maddie has no food in her cupboards, and I've bought her dinner 3 nights in a row. I'm like, oh, okay. So I came home and we sat down, and they encouraged them on youth agreements to have part-time jobs, but part of the requirement is you have to give your pay stubs in because they keep them under the limit where they would have to pay taxes. So they adjust all of their supports to make sure that they don't get into that range where they have to file taxes at the end of the year at that age. And so you have to report your income, which means you have to give your pay stubs. And she wasn't getting her pay stubs because they mixed up her email address, and they had cut off her funding for her groceries. So my rent was being paid, but her groceries hadn't, she hadn't received her grocery money that month. And I sat there listening to this and thought, this is not a child who's ready to be independent. She's just not. Like, this is because the fix is you call the office at work and you get the right email address, you get your pay stubs and you submit them. But the response Maddie had at the time was she just shut down. She didn't know what to do or where to go, and she just kind of closed up. And so the problem kept getting worse. So that night, I said, okay, this is, first of all, there's plenty of food in this house. Eat. Like, we're going to change our agreement, and your rent is now your room and board, because there's no reason anybody in this house should be going hungry. And then I started getting more involved with her, and I started sort of like checking in and how is school going and how are we doing with our appointments this week, and kind of getting more involved. And she was open to it, which was really good. And she started chatting a little bit. And eventually, but she had a lot of very negative views of herself. And one day, I sort of sent her I was trying to say something to her, and she said, oh, you don't understand. I was terrible. I was a terrible human being. And I said, okay, tell me what you've done that's so terrible. Like, let's just talk about this. I want you to tell me all the terrible things that you have done. And she started off very hesitantly, and we were kind of 20 to 25 minutes in, and I said, "You haven't set listed a single thing that one or both of my biological children haven't done. They've never been beaten, they've never been kicked out, they've never been emotionally or mentally abused over it. You haven't listed anything that makes you terrible." "Well, I've done more." "Okay." So then we kept going, a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. And I said, "No, there's still nothing. Like you And in the end, there were a few things that, yeah, she had done. And I said to her, "That's what you did was survived. You survived very, very difficult circumstances in situations you've never been put in to begin with, and you survived. And there is nothing wrong with that. You should be proud of that. That resilience that you've shown, that you've gone through all of these things in life, and at 16 you were still in school. You weren't addicted. You weren't pregnant. You were still trying to get yourself the help you needed. Like that's, you should be proud of that." And that,
Right.
as we were having that conversation, I said to her, "Has anybody ever told you you weren't the problem?" And she looked at me. She said, "What?" I said, "You weren't the problem. It wasn't the 2-year-old that was the problem. It wasn't the 5-year-old in the room that was the problem. It wasn't the 8-year-old or the 12-year-old or even the 15-year-old in the room that was the problem. It was the adults around you who didn't have the ability to give you what you needed. And that's their life story. That's not, I mean, I'm not judging them for where they came from either, but you were not the problem. If you're still doing this when you're 30, you're going to be the problem then, because it's your choice as an adult how you respond to things and how the choices you make. You're in charge of where your life goes from this point on. But sweetheart, it wasn't the 2-year-old in the room that was the problem when all of this stuff was going on." So eventually, Maddie, when she first moved in with us, she still had a relationship with her biological mother, and they still. Mom called and she'd go, and they'd have, they had a relationship. And I was dating my now husband at the time, and he brought up the one day he said, "We should adopt Maddie." And I said, "No." I said, Maddie still wants a relationship with her biological family." I said, "So our job is just to support her in that, and that's where it is." "Okay." And eventually, when Maddie was about 20, it became apparent that she had decided she was going to terminate that relationship, that she wasn't going to continue with that relationship with her biological family. And by then, my husband and I were getting married, and we did in fact adopt her. So Maddie ended up our daughter. So that's the real life Maddie story. And after we'd finished the first book of You Can Do Hard Things, I thought, I really want to tell a story for Maddie. That shows her resilience, because that was what struck me that day when they asked me if I would take her in. Was here was this kid who was 16 who clearly had a difficult background, clearly had all kinds of issues that she had dealt with in her life, and man, she was still trying to move forward and do the right thing and make the right choices. So I sat down and I wrote a children's book version of her story. So obviously it's cleaned up. There's not a lot of details. It just talks about Maddie's family had grown-up problems. And that's it. But it shows her story, and it shows how she would walk into school with her backpack on her shoulder, and that bag had everything she had in it, and how she was a little bit dirty, and a little bit, the hair wasn't brushed properly, and the things that she had to go around trying to find her spot. And so Maddie Finds Her Place was born. And when I wrote the story and I put it aside, and then I was talking to her. She was up in Edmonton, working. She was about 22, I think, at the time, maybe 23. And she was working. And I said, "Hey, I want you to read the story." I said, "But this is your story." So I said, "If you want me to publish it, I will. But if you don't, that's okay too. I didn't write it for that. I wrote it for you. I think it's great, but it's on you." Because I said, "If I publish it, people are going to know it's about you, right? It's not. Like, we can pretend that's not who this is about." And so I sent it to her. I emailed it up to her. And she called me about 2 hours later. And she says, "Well, I sobbed for an hour, but I want you to publish it." And I said, "Okay." So we started the process. And what I found really interesting was, in my head, I wanted to publish the story because I wanted other kids like Maddie to see themselves in a book, to see that there are other kids out there that are struggling with the same kinds of issues, that maybe don't have a good solid foundation in their homes, and that there's hope there, and that you got to hang in long enough to find. And one of the things that I don't know if you noticed in the pictures there at all, but the lady who eventually Maddie moves in with was in the background in every single picture.
Oh, you did an Alfred Hitchcock thing
She's
where
there
you're
in
every
every
one of
page.
the, you're on every page.
I am in every page. Yeah. The page. So when you look, there's two things in almost, the lady's in the background in every image somewhere.
Wow.
And that was kind of my message, right? Is that the people that will help you are out there, but you have to find them. And you have to hang in there long enough to find them.
That
So
is so powerful.
And that was so that was my idea. But it was really what I thought really interesting was when I talked to Maddie about it, she said, "No, that's not why I want you to publish it. I want you to publish it because I want the grown-ups to realize we're out there." And for her, she said, "The kids, we all know we're out there. We see each other and we recognize. I want other grown-ups to realize that we're out there and we need help and that they should help." Which, that I had never really thought of it that way. It was a really, in my mind, somebody once asked me, "Well, why would you help her?" And my immediate response was, "Well, why wouldn't you?" And they sort of looked at me. I'm like, I had a big house with 5 bedrooms and 2 dogs. I own a business. I'm financially stable. I have all of this tutoring experience and coaching experience and life experience. Like, why wouldn't you help somebody if you saw that need? And it just, I mean, unfortunately, it kind of ended that interview, but it's really how I feel, right? Like if you're standing there and there's somebody in front of you that needs help and you have the ability to provide that, why wouldn't you?
Do you feel that we as adults, as I travel the country talking and training parents and school teachers and things about child abuse and things of that order, I always get so irritated when people say, well, kids are resilient. Other mom and dad's going through a divorce. Oh, they're resilient. Don't worry about it. They'll be all right. It'll roll off. It's like, no, they're not. Kids have resiliency in them, but they're not automatically resilient. It takes people like you to have a relationship with Maddie to show her how to find, discover what's inside you. I think maybe it's a gift that's in there by our creator, but it has to be tapped into. And if you would have tapped into that, her life would be different now. But don't you think that, like you said, if they're standing in front of us, we should take the time and the effort to help them find what they can do hard things and discover it. But it's just not automatic. I think we play that off too many times, and we need to embrace our kids more than what we do.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's just like empathy, resiliency is a learned skill. And so you have to parent with both, and you have to teach with both, and you have to coach with both, and you have to recognize the feelings that kids are having, but also help them work through those feelings and go, move on to the other side of it. I can remember my son with his first breakup of a serious relationship, and he said, "I'm just so sad, Mom." And I said, "That's okay. Just be sad." And he kind of looked at me. I said, I know it feels bad, but just be sad." I said, "And tomorrow you'll be a little less sad, and the next day you'll be a little less sad, and one day you'll wake up and you'll realize it was noon and you didn't even think about it yet. And it's okay." But I said, if you try to shove that away, you try to pretend that you're not sad, then you're just angry. And angry boys make terrible decisions, and then moms have to come rescue them. And he kind of laughed and went, "Yeah, okay, Mom, whatever." But it was true, right? It was this idea that it's okay to be sad and just admit that it is sad. I mean, this was a relationship you had hoped for. It didn't work out for whatever reason. It's okay just to be sad about it.
Do you think our world, our school systems, I don't know about Canada as compared to United States, we're so interested in the children's IQs, and we give no relationship or value into their EQ, their emotional wisdom, their emotional ability, because I think you can be the smartest person in the world, but if you don't have the ability to be able to emotionally handle things, you're going to crack. And I think there has to be a mix of that. And I'm not saying the school ought to be teaching all of that, but parents should have a vital role in not always cram the textbook down, but also learn the life lessons in the process. And I think that's what one of the things your books do so beautifully. Gives them that emotional content.
Yeah, it was really interesting when I was first working with my publicist. Actually, it was my future daughter-in-law. So my son is engaged, and I was visiting them, and she was working in the living room while I was having a Zoom meeting with my publicist initially. And we were talking about sort of the books, and he was saying, we should make this a series. And he and I had very similar conversations. And as I said, we've got the next two books coming already, and what they were about. And but I couldn't for the life of me think about what do I want the name of the title to be. And my future daughter-in-law is an incredible artist. She went to Emily Carr University with a fine
Wow.
arts degree. She's a tattoo artist now. She's just does spectacular work. And so she's the arts. Now I own an accounting and payroll. And as I explained in the beginning, I have no visual acuity at all. If I close my eyes, I don't see anything. I see numbers and I see words. That's what I see. So not a lot of creativity that way. But I got off the phone and I turned around and she popped her head up and said, "You should call it Little Lives, Big Feelings." And I went, "Oh." She's like, "Yeah, you should call it Little Lives." She said, "I thought that was really interesting. It's the first time I've heard the reasons behind the stories themselves and the plan." And she said, "I think you should call it Little Lives, Big Feelings." So Georgia is in fact the one who named the series. But it was about this idea that we want to talk about feelings. Our second book is called, or the next book to come out, I apologize. One moment, please. I apologize.
Oh no, you're fine. You're fine.
I've got claws on the doors that are interrupting
I was
everything
hoping the
here.
dogs have run through, to be honest with you.
Well, here they are. They're here now.
So this is the third book that's coming out. What's
So
the
the
title
third
of
book
it?
is called Everybody's Different, and it was about my son who didn't like anybody because they didn't do all the exact same things he did. And he goes around, "I didn't like this person because of this, and I don't like that person because of that." So it's a little bit more lighthearted and just about how, just because people are different doesn't mean you can't like them. And then the fourth book is Grandpa Is Just Like Me. And my husband now has ADHD and autism. And so does my grandson. And so my grandson, it brings him a lot of comfort to know that his granddad's his papa, he calls him, that papa's brain works the same way as his, and that papa had the same struggles to control his emotions and had the same difficulties in learning to socialize. And so book four is all about Papa and River and how they socialize together. So it's the whole series of them is about.
Well, that's great. I tell you, I want to have you back when the other three or the other two come out, and we can talk about the background and what those stories are like. Put up both of your books as I see the tail of the dog going like this. He's counting the time down. There they are. Maddie Finds Her Place, and You Can Do Hard Things, and they're available wherever good books are sold. And that in this world today is Amazon, Barnes and Noble, Books a Million probably. Target, maybe Walmart, things, those places like that. But you can type in Dana, Dana Sutton, Sutton. And you can also, I'm going to ask TJ for at the radio station to post all of your sites to where people can get a hold of you and ask you questions or order these. Shouldn't every library in the country had these books.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited to note that our library, our local regional library, has brought them in, and we've got some of them into some of the schools. We've had some therapists that have been really happy with them as well, for conversation starters. And so yeah, we're pretty happy with how things are going so far.
Well, that's great. I think every school ought to have them. So we have a lot of teachers that listen in to the program. I recommend these are awesome books to have a teacher. And what age group? So we know, I know they're big subjects, but what's the ideal focal age group if you'd say that's the perfect child age for these
So
books?
these books are meant to be read with adults. And
Yes.
so basically from preschool to grade to age 8 is kind of the age range we've aimed
Okay.
it at. And the idea is that you can have the conversations. And as I said, a reminder to everybody that, when we see things and we have a visceral response, that's our adult selves responding to that. The kids don't respond the same way. They're just seeing a
Right.
story, and it's an opportunity to talk to them in a safe environment about what potentially could be a red flag later.
That's fantastic. I tell you, every school library ought to have this, and I recommend teachers in second, third grade, fourth grade, buy these books, read them to your class in class, and have an awesome time sharing that with the children because I think it'd be an awesome discussion starter. You ever thought about doing a little question and answers in the back and things of that order to help parents as a key?
I haven't we've started to do some things like on my website you'll see there's a post that's lessons for my children, and they're the things that I want my kids to remember when I'm long dead and gone. Sorry. The idea, I think eventually we will do a parenting book once I'm not working full time and everything else,
Yeah.
and each of these lessons and things along the way will build into that
Well,
is the
just
ultimate.
reading it, talking about it, and sharing it opens up the discussion in a great way. So thank you, Dana. I know we're running out of time. I'd love to have you back. I thoroughly enjoyed this hour. It was worth waiting an extra week to have you on. And enjoy your dogs, enjoy your family, and
All right.
there's the books. Maddie can do Maddie finds her place, and you can do hard things. Get those books tonight. We'll see you next week. Thank you so much for being with us, Dana. Everybody,
Thanks
we
for
always
having
like to
me.
close the program each and every week with the same thought. And I think our guests, I hope, would agree with me that no matter what you've been handed in life, no matter what you're dealing with, no matter what you're going to face tomorrow, there's always hope. There's always hope. Look around, folks. You can always help somebody too. Be kind to each other, love each other, help somebody out, and let Dana's life be morale and lesson for us. Just look, why wouldn't you help her? There's always hope. God bless you. Thank you. Join us next week for another live edition. We'll see you. God bless. Have a good week.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1. For the next episode of Breaking the Silence.